So, Curiosity, August 2012, and this next series of slides is dedicated to the M12 explosive bolt. I checked to see if I could get one of these in Bunnings, but they don't stock them. But this is one of the most ancient and reliable pieces of space technology that humans have ever invented, where you can bolt a whole lot of heavy-duty kit together, and then by sending an electrical impulse down here, the bolt just explodes and everything separates. So in order to get Curiosity down onto the Martian surface, there are literally hundreds of these things all wired up, firing in a very carefully orchestrated sequence from some very fancy computer software that was adaptive and sensitive to the environment and ready to change the program at a split second's notice to try and recover. Things started going pear-shaped, and it all worked extraordinarily well. I think they said it took 7 minutes to enter the atmosphere and land, and it was 7 minutes of terror to the guys who did the programming and assembled the hardware. So pretty standard thing, lifting off with a Delta rocket into the low orbit, and then spin the spacecraft up to get some angular momentum, to get some high precision in the orientation, and inject it on the Martian on its way to Mars. I just wanted to do a digression on the physics here for a moment, because it's really difficult to get things off the planet, because the problem with rockets, which has been known now for more than 150 years, is that if you're going to accelerate a rocket into space, you do it by throwing things away. Namely, you throw away the exhaust of the rocket engine. So you start off with a rocket heavily loaded with fuel, and you throw away the fuel piece by piece, and you have to carry fuel to throw away later as you accelerate, until reach the desired final speed and you're on your way to the other planets or wherever you're going. And this is a terribly inefficient process, and I'll just give you a quick derivation here. I hope you're following this. It'll be on the exam. But this was... this actually, this is rocket science. This is rocket science. Pretty simple first year physics problem, conserve momentum over small time intervals and then integrate over the entire burn time, first derived by the Russians in 1903. And at the end of the day, you observe the rocket equation, the final speed minus the initial speed, and I've put in the initial speed to make it general, because the initial speed, if you're smart about where you launch your rockets from, you can pick up for free the orbital, the rotation speed of the Earth. So here in Melbourne, as you probably know, well-educated audience, the ground is going that way towards the east at a speed of about 1,300 kilometres an hour. Okay, we know that because new things keep appearing as we head towards them in our, as we go around the line of latitude. Now, it's interesting, if you go to Singapore, the ground is going to the east at about 1,670 kilometres an hour. Because of the equator, you've got a lot further to go. It's about 40,000 kilometres around the where Singapore is, only about 32,000 kilometres around here. And I've worried about this a lot, because that 350 kilometre an hour difference is not insubstantial. And I worry, with all these cheap airlines, you know, does that Delta V get included in the cost of the ticket? You know, so I urge you, if it looks like a really good deal, just check they've included 350 kilometres kilometres an hour of Delta V in taking you up to Singapore, because it'd be a hell of a run when you got off the plane if they didn't. Consequently, I calculated I was 110 grams lighter in Singapore than I am in Melbourne because of the centripetal force. But a quick trip to Sammy's curry house soon fixes that. So if we look at the rocket equation here, so the initial velocity should be, you should launch your rocket as close to the equator as you can and fire it to the east, obviously. And you pick up a free 1,600 kilometres an hour. And the final velocity needs to be the escape velocity of the Earth. And this is equal to the exhaust velocity, the speed with which you throw the burned fuel away, times the natural logarithm of the ratio of the initial mass to the final mass. Now, this is very depressing, because natural logarithm in here means that the mass of your rocket escalates unreasonably, well, logarithmically, in proportion to how fast you want it to go. So if you want to go fast, you have to go fast to get off the planet, you've got to maximise the ratio of the initial mass to the final mass. You need a really heavy rocket, and you can only put a little bit into space, and you need a really fast exhaust velocity. So you need 11 kilometres a second to escape from our planet. No smaller speed will do. And the best chemical fuels, liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, burn together in a good engine, escape the engine with a speed of only 3 kilometres per second, much less than the escape velocity. So you've got to burn the engine for a substantial period of time to accelerate. And when you plug these two numbers into this equation, the initial mass divided by the final mass has to be 55. So with a single stage rocket, only 2% of the mass can go into orbit. The other 98% has to be thrown away, the fuel. And when this was worked out, first, people thought the space was closed to humans, because there's no way we could build a rocket with better than this, if we confine ourselves to chemistry, of course. Physics has since opened a lot more fuels for which this is pathetic. But anyway, we'll get back to that in a moment. So that led to the idea, okay, not only do we have to throw the fuel away, we've got to throw most of the rocket away as well. And hence the idea of staging, which was the solution that got around this very unfavourable result. And if you look at all the fuels that are available, looking for something with a higher exhaust velocity, you can see here solid fuel, homebrew. I'll show you some experiments in just a second. 1,300 metres per second. Liquid oxygen, kerosene, the first stage of the Saturn rockets, 3,300. Methane is still experimental. Oxygen and hydrogen, pretty good. This has never been used. This is ozone and liquid hydrogen. This would be extremely unstable. And even better, monatomic hydrogen, oxygen and liquid hydrogen. So this is, instead of O2, this would be O1, 7,400 metres per second. The only drawback of that, if you went up to the rocket while it was sitting on the pad and did this on the fuel tank, that monatomic oxygen would spontaneously convert to molecular oxygen, and that wouldn't be good. The Nerva program, you could, well, sideways probably, yeah. In the 60s, it was thought we could do better. You can make a gigawatt nuclear reactor in a very small, just a metre or so diameter cylinder, pass hydrogen through it, and it will come out at a very high speed. The trouble is, this is an inherently unstable and extremely dangerous design, because the fuel also cools the reactor. So as you run out of fuel, the heat hasn't got anywhere to go, and it's very dangerous. Or a fusion plasma, no idea how to do that. But Curiosity was launched on Atlas V. It used Russian-built engines. In fact, the Russians seem to be providing most of the big engines for the American space program these days. I guess it keeps them out of mischief. And solid rocket boosters, and a second stage burning hydrogen and oxygen. So I just put this in, this because the Nerva rocket engine was proposed seriously for some human missions to Mars. So you have the reactor. You can see it here, quite small, with the exhaust. This is mounted upside down. But they never solved the problem of how to keep the core cool once you ran out of fuel. And many of these experimental rockets suffered from meltdown of the fuel, in which case you had uranium vapor come out of the exhaust, which was not good. Apart from the fact it gave an enormous surge of acceleration just before it failed. And the atmospheric test ban would prevent that being used inside the atmosphere today. And there's often controversy about launching nuclear materials into space. Solid rockets are good because they're very simple. This is a flashback to, very nostalgic to see this now, to my experiments in the early 70s. mixture of zinc dust and sulfur was the propellant, and these things really performed beautifully, but sometimes this would happen. This was taken with an automatic camera powered by a mousetrap. Anyway, back to Curiosity. Enough of my misspent youth. So here is Curiosity being assembled, ready for launch. The rover itself weighed nearly a tonne, and it was embedded in a descent system weighing 2.5 tonnes, and there was about a half-tonne body that went around all of that to guide it from Earth to Mars. So we're talking some pretty heavy-duty machinery here. So here's the rover inside its carrier, about to be mated with the heat shield. And, of course, all this is held together with those M12 explosive bolts. And all these wires go back to the computers to be ready to fire them at the appropriate time. Now, outer space, hostile environment. No air, obviously, but also plenty of cosmic rays. So basically what happens here is that when Curiosity was on its way to Mars, its Geiger counters were recording strikes from energetic protons. And every time one of those things happened, periodically, a few times a month, it recorded these big spikes. And then it entered the atmosphere, everything separated, a parachute came out of an advanced design. The Martian atmosphere is actually too thin to descend all the way to the surface by parachute. The parachute would have to be too big. So this was the biggest parachute ever used on Mars, and then it used the rockets for the last stage. When the cruise stage was jettisoned and the heat shield was exposed and it entered the atmosphere, it had to change its balance, so it would enter the atmosphere with the velocity vector pointing out to the right here, so that the heat shield would absorb the heat. It didn't descend vertically. And I haven't got time to say very much about this, but it had to change its balance so that it had the correct orientation so the heat shield would absorb its heat. And if you're ever launching a rocket for future reference, make sure that the centre of pressure, which you can obtain by cutting out a silhouette of your rocket and finding where it balances, lies behind the centre of gravity, which is the where the rocket itself actually balances. Because if the centre of pressure is below the centre of gravity, the rocket will fly stably and be self-correcting. If the centre of pressure is above the centre of gravity, the rocket will flip over and anything could happen. So as Curiosity came down through the atmosphere, it actually had to jettison 6 tungsten weights, 25 kilometres each, to adjust the relative position of the centre of gravity and the centre of pressure to ensure a stable trajectory through the atmosphere. And those 6 tungsten weights then formed artificial meteorites, and the craters can now be seen from space when they eventually landed. And so here's the centre of pressure, just in the middle of the silhouette, and there was the centre of gravity with the tungsten weights down here to get the right orientation. So 6 artificial craters with tungsten vapour in them. So big heat shield, several megawatts per square metre of heat dissipated, slowed it down to twice the speed of sound, popped the parachute, and the parachute was actually captured from orbit. And this is a remarkable image of a spacecraft observing another spacecraft descending to the atmosphere, and you can even see the heat shield lying on the surface over here as it went down. Close up, very nice, with the Gale crater in the background. And then once the parachute had done its job, it was jettisoned and it descended the rest of the way by rocket. These were hydrazine thrusters. Hydrazine is an excellent monopropellant. It explodes violently in contact with a catalyst and generates an enormous thrust. So there was about 0.5 tonne of hydrazine on board for this last stage, with the rover dangling precariously underneath on a piece of rope that looks like it did come from Bunnings. And then when the wheels touched the surface, the rope was cut with a special explosive knife, and the engines were throttled up to maximum, and this flew away to a safe distance where it crashed. And the crash was recorded from the cameras on the Curiosity lander sitting safely on the surface. And if you look down from space, you can see the lander. You can see just barely on this image the disturbance on the Martian surface from the hydrazine exhaust as it sort of drifted across and touched down with a final burst disturbing the Martian soil. And now from space you can see all the debris lying around. So you can see where the descent stage crashed, some other fragment over here, the parachute flapping in the breeze, the rover itself, and the heat shield over here spread over several kilometres of the Martian surface. I don't know whether the EPA has anything to say about all this garbage, but valuable souvenirs. Down in the future, down on the surface, the cosmic ray strikes continue to hit the aircraft, and because the atmosphere does not block them like ours does, and you still see big spikes from high-energy protons passing through the electronics. So the motherboard is very fancy. It has to be capable of withstanding the upsets caused by a high-energy proton passing through the microelectronics. This is therefore what causes the human view to be different to what we see in this camera image. I've interviewed a number of astronauts about this, particularly guys who have been on long-duration missions on the space station, and they do report seeing this phenomena where you see flashes of light from cosmic rays passing through your eyeballs when you're in space. They said it's not much of a problem during the day, but it is a bit of a problem when you're trying to sleep, and flash, flash all the time as the protons pass through. I don't know how often you would see it, probably two or three times a day maybe, but it is something that would be a bit strange compared to our experience on Earth. I've tried to look for this myself. I don't go into space very often, but I do go to the edge of space very often by flying 10 kilometres above the surface of the Earth. This is my trip to the Chinese city of Harbin last year. I always like to take a Geiger counter with me when I travel. By putting it in my bag and putting it through security, and it gets a huge dose of X-rays, as you can see here, Melbourne security. And then as the aircraft descends 10 kilometres above the Earth, above the shield of the atmosphere mostly, the background radiation becomes enormously intense. There's an effect where the magnetic field suppresses the radiation around the equator, so it falls off as we cross the equator and then began to rise. I descended into Shanghai, changed planes, flew, and Shanghai security, those guys don't mess around. They've obviously got the X-ray machine turned to maximum compared to Melbourne, and then up to Harbin, and the background radiation in Harbin is much higher than it is in Melbourne. It's not much point trying to explain this to your fellow passengers, I've found. They're just not interested. But anyway, down into the Gale Crater, I just want to zip through to a couple of the highlights here because I've used up my time now. Curiosity, so big, a lot of electronics, big motors, solar power is... Sorry? That's it? No, okay. Oh, it's a phone. Oh, right, okay. Too big for solar panels. The solar panels are too feeble on Mars for a big craft like this. So Curiosity is powered by a nuclear thermoelectric generator. You can see this thing sticking out the back. It's basically a pellet of plutonium oxide surrounded by the infrared equivalent of solar panels. And they take the heat, convert it to electricity, and that's what powers all the instrumentation. So it can operate 24/7, or I should say 24 and 40 minutes 7. Also, the waste heat is circulated in tubes carrying ammonia around the rest of the craft to keep all the electronics and the joints warm so that operates at the optimum temperature, and this will go for a long time. The Russians pioneered this, used them to power lighthouses along the Arctic Ocean, but not exactly best practice in the way they're managed. On board, there's a lot of instruments for detecting buried water, of which we see evidence also from space. And these consists of a neutron generator that blasts neutrons down into the surface from one side and picking up the neutrons scattering back out of the surface, and they scatter most prominently from hydrogen attached to water molecules. So the amount of neutrons scattering back tells you how much water there is in the soil, and it turns out there are lots. There's also this APX spectrometer. This is a very fancy piece of kit here. It's got a radioactive source that generates copious alpha particles. This is touched on a rock. The alpha particles go into the rock and induce X-rays, characteristic X-rays which come pouring back out, and they're detected, and you get an X-ray spectrum, and each peak corresponds to a different element in the crust, in the rock. And so this is a very direct and simple way of measuring the composition of the rocks. And it's used here on Earth routinely by the CSIRO and the people down at the synchrotron. And this is a very, very nice instrument. The way it works is that an alpha particle comes in and knocks out an electron from the inner shell of the nucleus, and then the vacancy is filled by another electron decaying down, and the surplus energy appears as these X-rays, and they're characteristic of the atom. Jeff Moseley discovered this in 1910 in his laboratory in Cambridge, and this sorted out the periodic table. A few years later, he was sent to Gallipoli and was killed by a sniper's bullet, a tragic loss. He would have got the Nobel Prize. I do it in my lab in Melbourne using a big particle accelerator, and this was an Aboriginal bead found in an Aboriginal midden, which we analysed, and you see the same peaks from the different elements. So lots of things. There's a laser for vaporising the rocks, and there's an X-ray spectrometer to look at the crystal structure. And just in the last few weeks, they've released data on this, what clearly looks like a sediment from the bottom of what was an ancient lake in the Gale Crater. And when you feed the... It's drilled up some of the soil, some of the rock, some of the sedimentary rock, put it into the spectrometer, and when you heat it up, what comes off? Huge amounts of water vapour. So this soil is highly hydrated. So this is a relic of the ancient lake that used to exist there. So from the landing point, Curiosity is headed over here, where there's a junction between three different soil types. So this is a scientific bonanza, this particular zone. I think we'll see a lot more interesting results come out in the near future. So what of the what then of the more distant future? Well, we'd like to get some Mars rocks back here to look at more closely, but this is a very challenging task. And perhaps one day we'd like to send people there. And even if you're a fan of Kim Stanley Robinson, with some judicious engineering, we could perhaps liberate the soil and the water from the soil, the carbon dioxide frozen into the ice caps, and one day we could return Mars to how it was 3.5 billion years ago. I don't think we should do that. We should celebrate Mars for what it is in its natural conditions and don't tamper with it. And above all, if there are Martian organisms there, don't contaminate them with Earth organisms until we understand doing. And one day in the future, we might overcome the limitations of the primitive chemical-powered rockets that we're using now. And this is a Project Orion that ran for 10 years in the early 60s, which the rocket equation could be bypassed entirely with a much more powerful form of propulsion based on fission. And Freeman Dyson was one of the architects of this, and the minimum size of a spaceship to go to Mars suitable for this sort of propulsion was 4,000 tonnes. And in fact, this sort of rocket scales unlike a chemical rocket. If you had a spaceship that was perhaps more like 100,000 tonnes in mass, then the fuel would only need to be about 5% of the total mass. So this is a really major game changer. The designs are on ice, available for the future, and perhaps one day, and it could have been built with 1950s technology, and one day perhaps those plans will see a new life if we discover another planet-busting asteroid heading our way, because it's the only thing we could assemble fast enough that would be powerful enough to do anything about saving the planet. And it will happen, but who knows on what timescale. Our planet has periodically been hammered by these huge asteroids. The only certainty is that it'll happen again. We're not sure why, when, but we'd like to do something about it. This could be the answer. Thanks very much for your attention.